This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. What if crimes could be stopped before they even happen, or a terrorist plot foiled before it ever gets off the ground? That's the promise of big data policing, but at what cost? Andrew Guthrie Ferguson, professor of law and a national expert on predictive policing, big data surveillance, and the Fourth Amendment, initiates a conversation on the new tactics being used all over the country in his latest book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. It's published by NYU Press, and I am pleased it brings Andrew Guthrie Ferguson to the show. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Let's start at the very beginning. Can you please define the term big data? What exactly does that mean?
So big data is everywhere in our lives now in a digital age, right? It shows the difference of data in velocity and variety and the volume of information that's being tracked from our cell phones, from our digital imprints online and almost everywhere we go, from our smart homes to our smart cars to our Fitbits on our wrists and everywhere else. In terms of policing, obviously we are also in a world where police are collecting more information about us through new surveillance technologies, through just better data collection about the people who come through the criminal justice system. And so we have a world now where software is now predicting future crimes, cameras are recording our public movements, and algorithms are generating virtual most wanted lists. And all of this is this idea of big data, more information than we ever had in the past.
Okay, so police are collecting all of this information. I'm thinking, so legally speaking, can the police have access? Do they have access to our purchasing habits and our web browsing, anything we post on Facebook or Instagram, anything that we do on social media?
So it depends on actually the technology and the service you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, in an investigatory capacity, if the police have enough cause, they pretty much can get almost everything we have given to third-party providers. If they went through to get a warrant and to get appropriate judicial approval. The rest of the information, the stuff where they're not necessarily looking for a particular crime or a particular investigation, there are restrictions, of course. But like any other consumer, if they wanted to, in many of these situations, they actually could purchase it. Just like if you wanted to spend the money, you could go buy the big data information about other individuals, about other people that might be interested in, that you want to advertise to and the rest. And so it is available. It is technically possible to get, but there are some, obviously, legal protections, and there are also some cost prohibitions that it's not really in the interest of most local police departments to go figure out what everyone is purchasing in a broad sense.
Mm-hmm. So this is the first book. Your book is the first book to examine the growth and consequences of algorithm-driven predictive policing. And I've talked about this before on the show about something that the president of the Knight Foundation talked about, Alberto Ibarguen, the president of the Knight Foundation, making the overall statement that algorithms have parents, that there are people who are writing these algorithms. So I'm wondering, who writes the algorithms that are now being used to comb through big data?
So it depends. So if you go to Chicago and the Chicago's heat list, which is a list of individuals they think are most at risk for violence, either being perpetrators of violence or victims of violence, that was created by an academic at Chicago ITT who created this algorithm with the Chicago Police Department. If you go to Los Angeles Police Department has a relationship with Palantir, the big company to do some of its own social network analysis. There are lots of smart-ups in the game who are creating predictive policing technologies like PredPol and HunchLab that are private companies that are selling technologies to police to add to their efficiencies and being able to determine patrols, where they go and what they do.
So you write that this book arises out of the intersection of two cultural shifts in policing. What are those cultural shifts?
So I think we have a shift of technology. We're obviously getting better at the information we can collect and to do with it, right? We had much of this information before, but the computers weren't sophisticated enough to do anything with it. You couldn't search with it, and you couldn't address it. But there's something else that's going on here, right? We are in a cultural moment where police are responding to the real racial tension in America, and communities are responding to the real racial tension in America. And the lure of big data policing is a lure of objectivity. It's a lure of that maybe if we just follow the data, we can avoid some of the problems that have caused communities in Ferguson and Baltimore and New York to protest police as they have. But it's a false lure, right? Because as you
say... I was about to ask. Go on.
The information is coming from police. It's coming from communities. It's coming from people. And the implicit and explicit biases that are creating that data get sort of brought through the algorithm, get laundered through the algorithm. And so the outputs aren't nearly as objective as you might think. But here's the reality. And here's why it's so tempting and why there is such an allure is that everyone wants, or police want an answer to, well, what are you going to do about the racial tensions in America? And big data policing gives you an answer. Like, it may not be a fully correct answer, it may not be completely nuanced, but it is an answer, and it allows you to sort of push forward in a way. I think that's part of the reason why it's been so attractive to police chiefs who have a really difficult job. You know, police chiefs have to answer the impossible questions of life, like, what are you going to do about crime, and what are you going to do about the tension between communities and police? And the real answers to those questions involve more money, more education, anti-poverty programs, which they don't control. But if they can say they have a new technology, they have a black box technology that's going to allow them to do more with less, it's really attractive to them. And it's been pushing the technology forward and the adoptions forward.
But, I mean, you say this big data policing gives the police the answer to a lot of questions. But, I mean, that's from the perspective, you know, for the police, it gives them answers. But for the community, will the response to the answer, the action taken because of the answer that's been given, are those actions going to be things that the community wants?
I think probably not. And even worse, the communities at this moment aren't really engaged. Part of the reason I wrote this book is that policing is such a fragmented reality, right? But there's like 18,000 different law enforcement agencies. Each one is different in every city and a place. And we haven't had a national conversation about whether we're okay with these new surveillance technologies, whether we are okay with threat scores being put on our citizens. Right now in Chicago, everyone who's been arrested for the last 4 years has gotten a threat score, gotten a heat list score, right, from 1 to 500 that pops up on the dashboard of a police officer when he pulls you over. And that is a decision because they really want to focus on like the people who have the highest scores and to direct their attention to those people. And that might make sense. But I think there needs to be a conversation about whether we're okay with police officers creating threat scores on citizens.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Andrew Guthrie Ferguson, law professor at the University of the District of Columbia, about his new book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. And professor, this threat score from 1 to 500, what are all of the factors that play into someone getting a particular threat score?
So it's changed over time, but right now Chicago is using and looking at your prior arrests for weapons, violence, or narcotics, whether you have been the victim of a violent act or an assault, your age at the last arrest, the lower the age, the higher the risk score, and then kind of the trend line, whether this is going, you know, increasing in crime or increasing in risk or not. And the risk score itself identifies both people who might be perpetrators of violence, might actually go out and shoot someone, but also people who might be victims, recognizing that this sort of focused, it's a theory of focused deterrence, this idea of focusing on the people who might be involved in violent actions and reactions and retaliatory actions are the places where police should be focusing their resources. But the result is a threat score, a score that no doubt will impact officers when they interact with this individual on the street. As maybe it should, right? If you're a police officer, you kind of want to know whether this person has some score if you can get more information. But it will change. I think it will change reasonable suspicion on the street. I think it might impact use of force on the street. And I think at a minimum, it is something that we should be having a conversation about, mm-hmm. about whether we're okay with it.
And it'll change use of force. Again, I keep going back to is that change going to be something that is to the betterment of the community, or could it make use of force actually worse because people have bad so-called threat scores?
Well, here's where it gets complicated, right? So if, you know, you or a friend of yours is in Chicago and they get run through the system, they see that you have a non-existent threat score, it might actually change for the benefit of you how police treat you. It might actually say, well, this person has no prior contacts, no prior arrests, has a clean thing. I will treat them as a person with a low threat score. But of course, the people who are getting into the system, people who have arrests or have contacts, who are victims of violence, suddenly will be giving higher scores, and that will change how police interact with those individuals, whether, you know, explicitly that they're conscious of it, or implicitly that it's just going to color how they see the actions and reactions of this individual that they stop or they interact with.
On this prior arrest, I mean, just because someone is arrested doesn't mean that they go on to be convicted. So on these threat scores, does it make a distinction between, the person was arrested, but they've been cleared, it was a minor thing, everything is okay with this person? Is that noted there, or is it just the fact that the person's been arrested?
It isn't as nuanced as you would hope. And it's actually why I pick on Chicago, because I think using arrests is known to be a false flag for prior risk of violence. And I think there are other other programs don't use arrests for fear or recognizing that pretty much police arrests is about where police patrol and what police do. If you use actual convictions, there's a whole process that went into that. Mm-hmm. If you use, you know, calls for service of crime, well, that's more objective because there's a victim reporting that something happened to them. But using arrests in Chicago, remember last year, the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division went to Chicago and did a really in-depth review of Chicago police, and they found some really troubling patterns, troubling patterns about racial bias, implicit and explicit, that should cause concern that if you're building a system that is following the patterns of police patrols and police interactions, that you really are going to be creating a lot of people who are getting the system based on where the police are patrolling and where they're focused on.
So, I mean, we talked about the lure of objectivity with this data, and as you can tell from my questioning about these threat scores, about the impact of this data on communities of color, particularly African Americans, I'm just wondering, how can big data, can it be used to minimize injustice towards African Americans?
Well, I think big data could be used in two ways. One is you could actually separate out sort of the predictive analytics of risks from the policing remedy. So one of the things that I find interesting is that maybe the problem with predictive policing is the policing part of it, right? The idea of identifying, you know, human beings who are at risk of being shot seems like a positive thing if the intervention is, how do we prevent this guy from getting shot? If there are correlative factors that involve poverty and, you know, lack of economic mobility and the rest, the risk identification piece is a positive if the remedy tries to deal with those underlying causes. So maybe what our mistake is funding it through the police, as the police being the solution to these underlying social services programs, and maybe the algorithmic scoring and the rest could be used if you were using for, you know, a heat list for social services, or a heat list for kids who aren't getting enough food to eat, or a heat list for, you know, people who can't pay their electrical bill, like, and helping them out. That might be a good use of some of this big data, this targeting, this analytics that's going on, and maybe it's just the policing remedy that isn't the best use of those resources.
Now you're talking, Andrew. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Andrew Guthrie Ferguson, law professor at the University of the District of Columbia, about his book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. Later on in the show, Paul Kix with his book about one of the untold stories of the French Resistance during World War II, and Chef David Leibovitz on the delights and disasters of making Paris his home. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back with Professor Ferguson after a break. And we're back on Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and speaking with Andrew Guthrie Ferguson about his book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. as before we went to the break, we were talking about police departments' use of big data and threat scores and troubling things like that. But as we were talking, and as I've been reading the book and preparing for this, the thing that kept coming to mind is CompStat, which then Mayor Giuliani used to great fanfare here in New York City as a way of pinpointing and zeroing in police resources on communities, on high crime communities. What you're talking about, it takes that and just explodes it exponentially, no?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, so predictive policing is the next evolution from CompStat, which was really, you know, the collection of data about crimes and then changing police patrols based on that past information. This is the predictive version of it, where we will predict that because there was crime in these particular places at this time, there will be crime in the future at this particular location, so we'll send the police officers to that location before the crime in the hopes that the presence of the police in that area will deter the future criminal.
You know, and again, another thing that came to mind as I was reading and preparing for this is that Tom Cruise movie from, I think, the late 90s, early 2000s, Minority Report, where it was all about predictive policing, but instead of collecting data, big data, as you're calling it, they use these what they call three precogs. But the idea that police could predict crime before it happens and arrest people before they actually committed the crime is something that was so outlandish then. But considering that you've written this book and where police departments are, I mean, it's no longer just the figment of Hollywood's imagination. Like, this is real.
It's still a little science fiction. So the theory behind place-based predictive policing is that some crimes are almost viral. They're sort of contagious, right? If there's a house that's burglarized in one neighborhood, it's actually statistically more likely that the houses around that house will also be burglarized. Why? Because either the same group of burglars are going to go back there, or just word gets out on the street that there's some environmental risk, there's some environmental vulnerability here that makes it more likely. So if you put a police officer at that location where you think the next burglary is going to be, and the burglars come back and they see the cop car, they're probably not going to do that kind of crime. That's the science behind it. It's not precogs in the world. The same thing with person-based predictive policing. You know, the idea is that there's a cycle of violence in Chicago. People don't fully trust the police to solve their crimes. So if you shoot my friend, I go shoot your friend. And these cycles of violence can be interdicted and stopped. And that's this idea of focused deterrence that sort of gets created into an algorithm, but it's a basic idea. It's not, you know, science fiction. There is some science behind it, but because, you know, of the human reality of it, there are some real risks involved about how it gets implemented on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, can we talk about the companies who are selling the algorithms to the police department? I mean, who are the big players in this field?
So in place-based predictive policing, you have small startup companies like Predpol, based out of California, Hunch Lab, based out of Philadelphia, Risk Train Modeling. It's not a company. It's two academics out of Rutgers. And then some big players like IBM and Motorola are getting into the game. They tend to be small enterprises, even the big companies are just a small enterprise, and they are selling sort of competitive products that they say will help police do more with less. And it's actually a pretty competitive environment right now. They're still trying to get contracts. They're still trying to convince people using past data that their system works. And it's still all in process. It's an evolution as it goes forward.
Does anyone audit their work? I mean, for example, to see if they get someone's profile wrong?
So, you know, all those I mentioned were place-based predictive policing and that they're actually where the police are going to patrol and where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. The audits for Chicago, which is a person-based system, which again was created by academics and Chicago PD itself, has been sort of audited by entities like Upturn, which is a consultancy in Washington, a nonprofit consultancy in Washington, looked at their numbers and said that, you know, a lot of the people in the system are, it's just an overbroad system. There's something like, again, like, you know, 200,000 of the 400,000 people who have been given a risk score would have some elevated risk level, and that doesn't really make sense. It's not targeted enough. And so there have been sort of academic attempts to audit. There have been probably eventually some internal governmental audits, which no one has revealed, but there hasn't been enough. And there even hasn't been a conversation about this problem, except for conversations like the one we're having now.
We've got a couple of questions from listeners that are actually really good. One listener wonders if individuals have a right to see their threat score, and if so, could they argue against it like one might a credit score?
Right now there isn't a transparency system where you can go get it. Maybe you'd find out about it if it came up through an arrest and you saw it in the police paperwork. But I don't believe there's a way where you can go ask for it or even ask the police to sort of amend it or correct it or add to it. We just haven't got to that point yet.
And remind me again, which jurisdictions are using this threat score? Is it all of them or one or two in particular?
No, I mean, so the one I've been talking about is really Chicago's. They've been sort of out front in leading with the person-based targeting. Los Angeles has a focus on chronic offenders, individuals they believe are involved in crimes, many people on parole and probation, that they target and have officers go out and contact over and over again to sort of keep tabs on them and then collect the data about where they are. New York City has a process where they're looking at the sort of primary targets in their area. It's not quite as algorithmically driven. It's more getting information from, you know, gang detectives and other and community members and other people. But they, too, have a sort of sense of the primary targets. But it's not transparent because it's all in the pre-investigatory or investigatory part of law enforcement.
And we have this next question is a bit of a twist. A listener called in and wonders if individuals or communities could maybe see the risk score for police officers who might be prone to excessive force.
So there's an entire chapter in the book that I call Blue Data. It says, well, what if we turn this like architecture of surveillance we've built on citizens, on the police, right? The same technologies of predictive analytics, of data mining and arrest could actually be used to improve police accountability and police training if you wanted to take the same technologies that we're using for individuals and do it on police. And there have been some interesting studies that I discuss in the book about how sort of data mining, what police do, and some of the real stressors of police life can be identified and modified to sort of avoid some of the necessary conflicts. And just like a quick example of it, in data science in Chicago, out of Chicago, went to Charlotte Mecklenburg to look at their policing system, and they identified by crunching a ton of numbers that officers who saw a really traumatic scene, like say a suicide or child death, tended to have a greater incidence of trouble or violence the next shift, right? And the reason being is officers are human beings. They saw trauma. They don't know how to process it. They haven't fully processed it yet. They go to the next crisis situation, they overreact. And if you understand that, you can identify it and maybe not send that guy or that woman to the next crisis scene. And that came from data mining. That came from this idea of being able to sort through the information and improve things.
You're listening to Andrew Guthrie Ferguson, Professor Andrew Guthrie Ferguson, about his new book, The Rise of Big Data, Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. And Professor Ferguson, you mentioned you have a chapter on blue data, but there are a couple of other data things I want to ask you about. One is black data. What is black data?
So my argument in the book is that all of these big data surveillance technologies have a black data problem. Black as an opaque because the data exists largely hidden within these complex algorithms. It's a black box problem. Black as in racially coded because the data directly impacts communities of color. And black is really distorting. It creates these like legal shadows and constitutional gaps where the law used to see clearly. Like we created a law in a small data age, and we're in a big data age, and the law hasn't caught up yet.
And then you have here, you write about bright data.
So bright data is the idea of what we talked about earlier of like separating out the risk identification from the policing remedy. That what if we took the good of this predictive analytics, the idea that there are certain communities that are more vulnerable, and there are reasons why. There's something in the environment that's causing crime and criminals to go there, and try to remedy. Instead of just putting a police car at the corner you've predicted to be a high crime area, how about fix up that area? Build a new building there. Build a school. Build a park, right? Those are are other ways you could use the same data with a different remedy. It doesn't have to be a policing remedy, but that's sort of where the fundings come from, and that's sort of our mentality that somehow we can police our way out of it, when really the risk identification that there are particular places of risk for crime and particular people involved in risk, you know, of risk or crime can be remedied with social services, economic opportunity, and other things. And that's the idea behind Bright Data.
I mean, what you said just now, what you said earlier before we went to the break, makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering, are local governments receptive to the idea you just proposed, using this data not for policing purposes, but for social services purposes, to actually help help communities, not just from a policing perspective, but from a social services betterment perspective?
I hope they read the book, and I hope they do get involved. Right now, we've seen some big cities recognizing that data can help them do city services in better ways. They can go find, you know, rodents. I saw that in Chicago. They're looking, they can actually use big data to find where the rats are, and that is helpful. You can find abandoned properties. You can do a lot with information. You can visualize things in a different way. But I really hope that we focus our funding and our sense of the future on recognizing that the remedies shouldn't just be policing. Maybe policing in addition to a lot of other social services.
Now, Professor Ferguson, we've been having this whole conversation about predictive policing and big data, but I'm wondering, how does predictive policing conflict with Fourth Amendment guarantees?
I think it impacts it. So if you take place-based predictive policing, you're a police officer, you are either following a map that has these little areas of predicted crime where you're supposed to go and sit and wait for the crime, or even in the more high-tech cars, you're literally going from neighborhood to neighborhood, and the colors on your computer screen change as you go from a high burglar area to a high theft area. You now have that information. So when you get to that location, you, the officer, can be primed to see the world as, this is a burglar area. And so when you see some individual on the street and he's carrying a bag, normally that's not enough to stop anyone. But now you're primed to think, hey, the computer told me this is going to be a burglar. There's supposed to be a burglary here, right? And here's this guy, he's holding a bag. Well, maybe this gets closer, right? And you can see how the technologies, be they identifying people or places, is going to distort a legal doctrine, the Fourth Amendment, that was built at a time of small data. It's just what the officer knew, just what the officer had. They didn't have any of some other inputs that are coming in and distorting their reasonable suspicion.
You know, the way you were describing that, my mind instantly went to stop and frisk, but that's a whole other conversation. In terms of a follow-up on this Fourth Amendment question, can we predict how the courts will react to predictive policing and the challenges to the protections afforded by the Fourth Amendment?
You know, it's difficult. Right now, the Fourth Amendment and the standards of reasonable suspicion or probable cause are already relatively weak. We're already in a situation where courts tend to, the Supreme Court tends to defer to law enforcement and their judgments. I would imagine if I'm a judge and I'm told by the officer on the stand that, look, I was on patrol, I was following the computer told me to be on the lookout for a burglary, I saw this guy, he looked like he might be a burglar, I think as a judge, it's going to be hard to discount that information. It's not that it should control, but it's going to be somewhat hard to discount it, in part because it would seem odd to have the police officer himself or herself discount that information. You're giving it to them for a reason. So if that goes into the calculation of the police officer, it's probably going to end up in the calculation of the court, and it's probably going to impact how the judge eventually determines the reasonable suspicion of the officer on the street.
So, I got to ask you this. How eager or receptive were police departments to have you come in and take a look at their war rooms to see how they were using this data?
I think police officers and police administrators are open to this discussion. I think that they recognize these technologies are coming through, and they have risk to them and the legitimacy of the policing and their cases and the Fourth Amendment, that they actually are open to a real dialogue. The chiefs of police in major cities in America are embracing technology in an intelligent way. and they're asking hard questions, and they're thinking through some of these concerns. And so I think it's been really a positive dialogue. My concern is that the rest of America, citizens like you and me and everyone else, aren't really paying attention yet. And we really need to have this in our communities. We need to have this discussion, you know, on the streets and in the churches and in the city councils and everywhere else to say, like, are we okay? Can we be in dialogue with the chiefs to determine maybe this technology is okay, maybe this one needs some checks and some audits, maybe this one is going too far? But we're not having that conversation right now.
Well, do you think we want to have that conversation? I mean, I know, like, in the churches and people in the communities, but at some point, those city councils and those local legislators are going to have to get involved. And it doesn't seem to me like there is any political will to have the other side of that conversation that you've been talking about throughout our conversation. And that is having the people's elected representatives be in dialogue with these police departments that you were saying are, you know, using this information and would like to have this conversation. But it's sort of a one-way street at the moment.
And that's sort of why I want the community to push the city councils to have this conversation. At the end of the book, I propose that we should have annual surveillance summits. Every year in every local community, there should be this moment of accountability and transparency where the chief of police with the city council should get up and say, look, this is what we're spending your tax dollars on in terms of surveillance. We bought the following drones. We bought the following cameras. We're using these technologies. Here's why we think it's a good use of your tax dollars. Here's why we think we'll check at the end. And then we have a debate with technologists and with city council members and with the community and everyone else, maybe a lawyer or two, to determine whether or not this is exactly the future we want. And those sort of annual audits will be this accountability mechanism that will allow the city council folks and the chiefs and the community, none of whom are usually technologists, none of them are usually constitutional scholars, to have a real dialogue about whether this is okay and whether this is where we want to go in the future.
And whether that data should be used in other ways, in ways other than policing. Professor Ferguson, would you argue, is my last question, would you argue that the historic crime drops in cities like New York are at least in part because of big data policing?
You know, I think that it's too complex to say that. I think that police have done a lot more with technology, and they're going to continue to do more. There are lots of economic and other, you know, drivers that change crime up and down. And so it will never be a silver bullet that some technology will fix it. It will never necessarily be the cause of some dangerous thing that the technology has changed it. And so I think it's a complex question that you can't say it's either, technology is neither good nor bad. It is, you know, changing things, and we just need to be staying up to date with how it's changing policing and who it's targeting, where they're going, and why we're using this data in our communities.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I've been speaking with Andrew Guthrie Ferguson, law professor at the University of the District of Columbia, about his book, The Rise of Big Data Policing, Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. Professor Ferguson, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Up next, Paul Kix with his new book, The Saboteur, The Aristocrat Who Became France's Most Daring Anti-Nazi Commando. And later on in the show, the one and only Dr. Ruth Westheimer shares her rules for lasting relationships. You're listening to Midday on WNYC.